My brothers and sisters, welcome to another episode of In Clawson We Trust, the White Power Hour with Reverend Matt Hale. I'm very pleased to be with you as always, as we proselytize and promote the greatest idea this world has ever known, creativity. A white racial religion for white people. A religion in which you can embrace your white people and not be ashamed of anything, not feel guilty for anything, not have any concern about going to an afterlife and in a lake of fire because you don't believe the Christian preacher, because you don't do what he says. Instead, you have a religion in which your race is your religion, in which your people is the focus of all things, in which everything revolves around the interests of your people. If it is good for white people, it is good. If it is bad for white people, it is bad. And on this basis, our great founder, Ben Clawson, formulated our religion of creativity. Let me urge you at this time, as I usually do, as I oftentimes do anyway, to read the two main books, in fact, the three basic books of creativity, Nature's Eternal Religion, The White Man's Bible, and Salubrious Living. Read these books, get all three books for $30, send to P.O. Box 2002, East Peoria, Illinois, 61611. Send this, read these books, and you will have the same flame of enthusiasm as I have speaking to you right now. You will have the same desire to go out into the world and proselytize, preach the message of white racial loyalty. We are loyal to our own people for a change. The other causes in this world completely negate or completely ignore the reality that what is most important in this world is white people. You can have any other cause, but if you don't address the continued existence of white people and their culture, you are missing the boat. And finally, after thousands of years of recorded history, white people have a religion of their own that we can call our own, which is off limits to the mud races. We don't have a situation like the Christians do, in which you have niggers walking into their church, even though some of the white Christians don't necessarily like that. We don't have the situation where any nigger wants to walk into our church, in which any nigger wishes to pick up our books and read them and recite the 16 commandments. No, we have a religion that is completely of, for, and by white people exclusively. On this particular episode of In Clawson We Trust, I'm going to be talking about a number of events and a number of issues, and so let me get straight to it. First of all, on a personal note, this is my 12th anniversary today of being a public figure. 12 years ago on this date, in 1990 old year, or 17 AC in our year system, I was first talked about on the nightly news. I first made news as a college student putting up flyers announcing a meeting of the organization I was part of then, the American White Supremacist Party, and of course the rest is history. 12 years later, of course, I am one of the most talked about white racial figures in the world. I'm very proud of this. I would not want it to be any other way. I am probably the most smeared white racial figure in the world. I would not want that to be any other way. When the Jews are vilifying and smearing me, I know I am doing something right. When their newspapers spread countless ink bottles upon their papers and are attacking me with that ink, well, I know that I am getting on their nerves. Well, we have to get on the nerves of those who are trying to destroy our people. We have to be the enemies of those who would seek to make sure that white children are no longer born in this world. We have to make sure that those who would nigrify and Jewify and mongolify our culture are put out of business. And so when they attack me and attack our beloved World Church of the Creator, I have a smile upon my face. Anyway, it's been in some ways a long 12 years. 12 years ago, I was somewhat of a naive 18-year-old, though I still had a vision. I may have not known the full story or the full way to go about winning the victory we all covet. But at that age, even at the age of 18, I knew what my destiny was. I knew that my destiny, my fate, would be to lead our beloved movement. I knew as early as I was 12 years old that this would be my destiny. I knew that my destiny would be to be a public speaker, to proselytize, to preach the message of white racial loyalty. I didn't necessarily, in fact, I didn't call it white racial loyalty back then. I didn't understand or maybe know the word, the terminology. I called myself a white supremacist back then, but it all amounts to the same thing. Preserving a place in the sun, winning. In fact, winning a place in the sun for white people. 12 years. It's amazing in some ways. Certainly, much of what I set out to do has been accomplished. I set out to become a public speaker, for example. 12 years ago, I couldn't speak to save my life. I was a nervous person. I was shy. I was introverted. I was a person who, when I came on television, I had nervous tics and everything else. And I say this, my brothers and sisters, for those of you out there who feel that perhaps this cause is almost too intimidating to do what I've done, not so. Not so. If you are a novice, if you are inexperienced, you can get the experience simply by going out there and preaching. In my case, the media helped me along. The media helped me a great deal because I was suddenly cast into the public eye. When I put up flyers at Bradley University advertising that meeting of the American White Supremacist Party, I put up those flyers not fully realizing what the consequences would be. I thought that, well, okay, I'll get some people to call me and they will come to our meeting and we might have a dozen people, maybe not. But lo and behold, what happened instead was I put up those flyers and the media was calling me and people were ringing my phone off the hook and there were demonstrations calling for my expulsion the next day from school and all kinds of things. So always remember those of you in particular who are the true activists, the incredible idealists who are plodding along every day, concerned perhaps about the consequences, concerned that maybe you'll lose your job because of what you do, maybe you'll be kicked out of school for what you do, etc. Remember, I was there. I'm always available for you. For your questions, for your comradeship, you can always email me, pmhale1@aol.com, or give me a call, 309-694-4444. It is true I am very busy these days. I can't always return every call personally, but if you make sure that you call that number and you say that you listen to this show and that, yes, you're an activist and, yes, you have some concerns, you need some inspiration, whatever you need, I will try to help you as much as I can because I was there. So it's not a situation with me, and I know all of you know this, but I like to reiterate it in any case. It is not a situation with me that I am simply a guy in an ivory tower and speaking from a mountaintop. No. No, I have been with you. I am a man of you. I am a man of the people. I have gone through the harassment. I have been fired from jobs. I have been penalized at school. At Bradley University, for example, for being a white racial loyalist. And 12 years ago, like I say, was the day that changed my life forever. And yet I'm very proud and very happy that I made that decision that day to put up those flyers. It is tremendously liberating to be able to say exactly what you think. Come what may, once you spit in the eye of the peer pressure groups, etc., and the Jew media and the non-white enemies of our people, once you spit in their eye and say, hey, I'm for the white race, and I don't care what you think about that as far as that goes, I am for the white race, I will support the white race, I am loyal to the white race, once you do that, it is tremendously liberating. As I like to tell people, for example, there is nothing like a street demonstration. It is tremendously invigorating to stand there with a sign that says, white and proud, white power, etc. Tremendously invigorating. If you haven't experienced it, you don't know what it's like. You don't know how liberating the feeling is. Some people, for example, they like to get high through drugs. Illegal drugs and legal drugs, etc. I mean, alcohol is a drug. Marijuana, of course, is an illegal drug, but they're both drugs in that sense. Some people like to have that as their high or that as their release. Well, there's a better release. There's a better high, and that is activism for the white race, including street demonstrations, for example, or giving a speech. Tremendously liberating. And you know when you're doing this that you are reaching people, that you are spreading the word, that you are putting a thorn, a big thorn in the side of this Jewish occupational government. Be proud of that and do it, my brothers and sisters. Now, the next item to talk about on this week's episode of In Klassen We Trust is an item that many of you probably already know about if you subscribe to our email list. And certainly, I might be somewhat redundant in this. Hopefully, I won't be too redundant. I have a number of sub-issues to talk about in relation to this main issue, but let me just get straight to it. Victory in the trademark case. Yes, indeed, we won the trademark case on Thursday of last week. The trademark case in which we were sued by a bogus Christ Insanity Church out of Oregon. Actually, they actually tried to exappropriate our name. They tried to take our name from us, claiming that we had infringed upon their trademark. Well, let me give you the history of this suit. Let me give you a history of this group, in fact. They're called Te-Ta-Ma Truth Foundation, Inc., also known as Church of the Creator. Well, it so happens in 1982, they were founded. In 1988, or 1987, they applied for, and in 1988 received a trademark on the words, on the name, Church of the Creator. They registered a trademark, in other words, on our name. We had the name since 1973. And there are other churches, and we found this out after the suit was filed against us, we found out that there are other churches across the country also named Church of the Creator. Now, obviously, from our standpoint, we don't like the fact that other churches have our name, but at the same time, it is very clear that as a matter of law, Church of the Creator is a generic name, and therefore not trademarkable. That's just a simple reality. It's like Church of God, or Church of Christ, or First Baptist Church. You can't get a trademark on names that are generic in nature. For example, if I were to try to get a trademark on the word waterfall, I couldn't do it. Waterfall is not trademarkable, or desk printing, or desktop publishing. You can't get a trademark on something that is in the public domain and common, something that is not distinctive. Well, let me back up a bit, because there's some history of the suit to recount here. In May of 2000, this suit was filed by this organization, represented by one of the biggest law firms in the country, Kirkland & Ellis, a law firm that has 1,000 attorneys working for them. And they brought this lawsuit hoping, expecting that we would roll over, that our World Church of the Creator would not have the resources to meet their resources. They expected to paper us to death. They thought that we would be a pushover. Well, one of the first things that we did, or one of the first things I did, is go ahead and announce that I would represent the church. And I filed the necessary paperwork that I would represent our church. And, of course, everybody in the church would accept such a notion and want such a notion. After all, I went to law school for 3 years. I know the law, passed the bar exam, and perhaps even more importantly, because I believe in the church, I would be the best person to represent the church as the leader, as the great promoter of the church. Well, as some of you know, basically what happened after that is that the other side opposed with every fiber of their being such a notion that I could represent the church. They immediately said, well, Mr. Hale does not have a law license, so he can't represent his church. Well, of course, we know why they did that. Why did they do that? Because they knew that if I represented the church, there wouldn't be any legal expense on our costs. There wouldn't be any attorney fees. I'd, of course, do it for free. And we would therefore not have to pay another attorney thousands and thousands of dollars of legal fees. That, in fact, brings out or points out why this suit was filed in the first place. It was filed to harass us. It was filed to bankrupt us. It was filed to divert your money, your support, from our necessary and appropriate operations in spreading the word of white racial loyalty and creativity and organizing our church around the world, and instead put it in attorneys' pockets, and hopefully put it in their pockets as far as they were concerned. Well, the judge unfortunately refused to allow me to represent the church in March of last year. It took a long time for that decision to be issued. But that was finally the issue, and that was something we had to deal with. And so I contacted an attorney. We made arrangements for him to represent the church. I would, however, write up the paperwork at his direction and his supervision. In other words, I would go ahead and write up these motions and answers and interrogatories and all the paperwork, basically, I wrote up, utilizing my knowledge and at his direction as far as him signing off on what I did. And, of course, everything, once again, was appropriate, what I did at his direction, and that's why he signed off on it. See, basically the way it works is that a non-attorney, a non-licensed attorney, can go ahead and write up basically whatever he wants as long as a licensed attorney signs off on it. And so I found myself in the situation similar to a law clerk, for example, who performs work of this nature, who really actually did all the work as far as the substantive work, but who, because he doesn't have a law license, doesn't have his name appear on the paper, on the printed page, and that's basically what happened. So, this suit was filed in May of 2000, and finally, on Thursday of last week, the judge agreed wholeheartedly with our motion for summary judgment that we had filed that Church of the Creator is generic and not trademarkable. Now, let me talk to you about what the consequences of, and let me say this, I was as high as a kite when this decision came down. I'm still as high as a kite, though, of course, it's been almost a week since the issue was, or since the decision was issued, and I have it now, I've gotten a little used to the fact. But in any case, let me stress to you, my brothers and sisters, just how incredibly important this decision was. And really, truly, this is something to celebrate and something to keep in your thoughts and in your mind. Because the consequences of being defeated in this lawsuit would have been grave. First of all, one of the things that the other side was seeking was a court order barring us from using our name. Well, obviously, we could get around that by not using the name or changing the name or something like this, but obviously, we have a vested interest in using our name. This is our name, World Church of the Creator, or Church of the Creator. We've always used both of the names, for that matter. You will notice, for example, on our holy books, our books were published years ago, and they bear the name Church of the Creator. If the other side would have been successful in stealing our name from us, we would not have been able to even sell our books or distribute our books. We would have had a court order prohibiting us from doing so. Now, of course, it begs the question, would there have been creators out there who would have obeyed such an order? Highly unlikely. The whole idea of prohibiting a religious organization from distributing or disseminating its religious beliefs is very anathema to the First Amendment. The First Amendment does not allow a government to prohibit someone from passing along a Bible of any religion, whether it's the Holy Babel, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, or the White Man's Bible and Nation of Eternal Religion. The First Amendment does not allow a government of any kind, whether it's a local government, federal government, state government, whatever it may be, to prohibit the free exercise of religion. And so that was one of our arguments as well in this case, though the judge did not make any ruling on that argument. She didn't need to, actually, and there's a principle in the law that basically says that if you don't need to make a decision on an issue because you have another reason to find in favor of a certain party, then don't make a decision. That's just the way it goes in law. Judges will want to do as little as they can. They have a lot of cases before them, and if you can resolve a case on one principle, you don't need to tackle five others, and we presented many issues in this case, and the main issue, though, was always the genericness of the name Church of the Creator. Just on its face, it's generic, and because of that, they can use the name. That's something that's been asked of me this past week, that they can, whether or not they can continue using the name, they can. They can continue to use the name, but we can continue to use our name, and furthermore, no one else can sue us on such grounds. This is case law as far as what you call it, basically, is collateral estoppel and also res judicata, two archaic or maybe arcane words that basically mean that if something is decided, then you can't bring it up again. If it's decided in one court, then it can't be brought up in another lawsuit by other parties and everything else, because it is the law now that Church of the Creator cannot be exappropriated by those who are hostile to our Church of the Creator. Now, the judge's decision. Certainly we're very happy about the judge's decision. It was a very fair decision. It was fair across the board. Not just saying that either because it was in our favor, but because it was objective. It was actually fair and even-handed, and it went right according to the law. We said all along that the law in this matter was very clear. There are statutes, in fact, that upheld our point of view, and the judge cited to those statutes. It was a very good decision, and certainly one of the things that we will be doing now is writing up a motion. I will be writing up the motion to recoup our legal fees. We pay thousands of dollars still in this case. We pay thousands of dollars because there are a lot of times when our attorney would have to make phone calls and drive to Chicago, and he charged by the hour, and this got to be pretty hefty, thousands of dollars of legal fees. I'm not sure exactly how much, but certainly tens of thousands. It would be over $10,000 for sure of legal fees, and obviously that will make you wince hearing that, and of course it makes me wince. That's what makes this victory all the more important and all the more beautiful, and that as much as they tried their damnedest to bankrupt us, to take our funds, to steal our name, to try to steal our religion from us, they failed miserably, and we're going to try to get this money back from them. We're going to try to get this money back from them because there is case law that says if you file a lawsuit that is oppressive and basically designed to abuse the other party, and that you don't have really a good basis for your claim, then you are liable for legal fees to that party. And we can make a very good case that here it was very clear. Church of the Creator, very clearly a generic name. They knew it was a generic name, and yet they brought the suit anyway to harass us and to do everything I've said, basically. So we're going to file this motion, and since the judge did rule in our favor that the name is generic and that the law is clear, there's a chance, though I don't know exactly what the chance will be. I don't know how to quantify it, but there's a pretty decent chance that when it's said and done, we're going to get back at least part, if not all, of our legal costs. And that will be the ultimate feather in our cap at that point. Because we've taught these people a lesson. We've taught the world a lesson. Our name is our name. We can't stop others from using our name in that sense. But nobody's going to take our name from us ever again. Ever try to, ever again. Probably the most significant victory that we have had in a long time, my brothers and sisters. And let me mention this as well. I didn't have this on the agenda for this week's program, but some of you might be wondering about the Attorney General case, what's going on with that. Well, the Illinois Supreme Court did uphold the constitutionality of the Solicitation for Charity Act in, I believe, December, and it was duly reported, or maybe it was November, and it was duly reported in The Struggle, our monthly publication. I might have even talked about it on this radio show. I've lost track, but in any case, the great news is that the Attorney General has not done anything since then, and the deadline has passed. So it looks like the law was declared constitutional, but the Attorney General has dropped, the Illinois Attorney General has dropped his vendetta against the church and has chosen not to go after the church with this ridiculous, equally ridiculous claim that our church is a charity and therefore has to report to the state its doings and money and contributors' names, etc. So this is very good. This is something that makes our victory in the trademark case all the more beautiful, and that we have continued with a string of victories. Even though the Illinois Supreme Court ruled erroneously and asininely that this law, this charity law, is constitutional, even though it doesn't even really define what a charity is, and enabled the Attorney General to abuse his position by bringing suit against us and claim that we're a charity and get all kinds of press for doing it. And he had a press conference when he brought the suit 2.5 years ago and everything else, and said he was going to shine the light on the financial dealings of the church and all these little lofty speeches, even though it was obvious that the law is unconstitutional. And I can't really go into, I mean, I could go into all the reasons why it was, but it's not really the focus of the show. Even though the Illinois Supreme Court ruled that the law is constitutional, is indeed constitutional, the Illinois Attorney General has not filed the necessary paperwork to take the case back to the trial court level, and therefore it looks like the case is not going to go anywhere, and that is wonderful. So, fair enough. He can go his way, we will go our way. He is working right now on his campaign for governor. Maybe he's concerned that another defeat at the trial court level would hurt his campaign chances. Whatever it may be, let him go his way. As much as we despise and hate this individual, this Jim Lion Ryan, as we like to call him, as much as that is the case, fine. There is a ceasefire, so to speak, in this war on that front, and so be it. Speaking of war, I wish to talk about this global war on terrorism. Everywhere you look, we see this war. As far as the trappings of it, it's on the news, it's in the newspapers. You see the flags, they're still pretty commonly seen, though much less than after or since the weeks of September 11th or after September 11th. The global war on terrorism is, of course, absolutely against the interests of America. The whole idea of having an international army, an army just fighting all over the world, is going to mean the harm of America. These political whores such as George W. Bush and his cronies of the Republican and Democratic parties are interested in taking the minds of the public off the real problems here at home. And so therefore we have this endless war that's practically even been called an endless war by Bush himself, that is obviously going to increase the number of enemies of America, is going to increase the possibility that individuals will attack buildings and infrastructure of this country. It increases the possibility of another September 11th happening, and yet these people persist. Let's analyze this, though, for a minute. Why does sending armies around the world increase the possibility of terrorism here at home? It's very simple. We have an open border right now. It has been open for a long time. We have numerous enemies, numerous mongrel mud races in America who come from countries that we've labeled as terrorist countries and who likely resent and hate America for this reason. We have the situation in which we are bankrolling the state of Israel to the tune of billions and billions of dollars a year, $20 billion a year now in military hardware, cash, everything else. And you have Arabs all over in this country now who, of course, hate the Jews, many of them, and see America as being a vassal state of the Jews. And so it's a recipe for disaster. How better to get back at Israel than to attack its friend, America, in that sense? And that's why we saw what happened on September 11th. And we talked about this in a previous show. If you put your finger in every pie, you might get a pie in the face. I guess that's the best analogy I can come up with. If we attack the Philippines today, there are going to be Filipinos that want to attack America tomorrow. If we attack Iraq tomorrow or today, as we're actually yesterday, there was some combat as far as a plane, one of the American military's planes flying over Iraq, really for no reason except to be shot at so that we can claim some kind of an excuse for attacking Iraq. If we attack Iraq, Iraqis are going to want to attack us. If we attack various countries in the world, or we give them ultimatums, or we try to blackmail them, or browbeat them, their people in America, their co-nationals, and their people overseas are going to want to attack us. It's very simple. If you have an octopus with many arms, and these arms are engaging in violence against various creatures, the creatures might start to chew on those arms or attack those arms. And that's what is going to happen. Now, we are not naive people. We are the World Church of the Creator. We white racial loyalists are not naive people. We fully recognize that the American government knows full well that it is putting America on a collision course with disaster. We know full well that Bush is a traitor to America and to the white race, and he represents everything we hate in this world, and he is deliberately doing what he is doing. But it is true that the people need to be brought this information. The people are being taken in hook, line, and sinker. We have to take a brief pause in the tape that we are making of this show, and I will be right back. My brothers and sisters, we are back with In Class and We Trust, the White Power Hour with Reverend Matt Hale, talking about the global war on terrorism and how it puts America at extreme risk. George W. Bush knows full well, the House of Representatives, so-called the Senate, they know full well that continuing this policy of antagonizing and threatening the world will only make more enemies of America, and the result, the manifestation of this policy will be another September 11th. They know full well. But see, if they can convince the people that they are doing right, and convince the people that they truly care about America, and they truly care about the main inhabitant of America, still white people, the people go along with whatever they do. And so it becomes really, it becomes a vicious cycle. If we attack Iraq, and Iraq attacks us back, or they have terrorists attack us back, what have you, then the government can justify more wars, more attacks on Iraq, they attack us continually, and it just continues forever. And so, once again, the minds of the people are diverted and distracted from the racial problems here at home, the economic problems here at home, the social problems here at home, the cultural problems here at home, all of them, of course, once again, revolving around the racial problem. It's the age-old technique. It's every individual who has studied Machiavelli, for example, or studied world history, knows that the best way to get people's minds off whatever problems exist at home is to go to war. And that's exactly what this government has done. The response to September 11th should, of course, been a curtailing of aid to Israel, eliminating all aid to Israel, ending, certainly if the government wanted to attack Afghanistan, there wouldn't be too many white racial loyalists that would be too upset about that, maybe bomb them into the Stone Age. Nobody would really worry about that so much, but once that is done, bring our military back to America, guard the borders of America, no longer have our finger in every pie. Let's not have our soldiers in Somalia feeding niggers. Let's not have our soldiers in Philippine jungles chasing terrorists. Let's have our military here in America and protect America. In fact, it brings up the point, the reality, or the notion of this homeland security business. You know, we've heard a lot of talk about the homeland security and how now that's a cabinet post and everything, to my knowledge. The Department of Homeland Security. I thought that was the military. What's this Homeland Security business? We don't need an extra department for Homeland Security. I thought that was the Army. I thought that was the Navy. I thought that was the Air Force, the Marines. Homeland Security, that's the military. That is what they're assigned to do. That is the purpose of the military, to protect this country, not to protect Israel, not to protect the Philippines, not to protect South America, wherever George Bushwhacker Bush wishes to send them. So, one of the things I wanted to do is, let's have a comparison between America today, the American foreign policy, and I hesitate to even call it American because it's Jewish through and through. It's not an American foreign policy, but in any case, the foreign policy of this corrupt government of today and the foreign policy of the American government 100 years ago. 100 years ago, the people in power, though they had some flaws, they made sense for the most part. 100 years ago, we had politicians who were steadfast about retaining American neutrality, America was neutral in all foreign endeavors. America did not involve itself in the troubles of Europe. America did not involve itself in the troubles of the Far East. America was for America. And further, I will note that 100 years ago, of course, while we had niggers in America, the niggers certainly did not race mix with white people. Nigger music was not being listened to by white people. The niggers knew their place, so to speak. There are hardly any gooks in the country to speak of. The Indians were on reservations, and as far as Arabs were concerned, there are hardly any Arabs in America 100 years ago. Was America more stable and peaceful and decent then or now? Well, the answer is very obvious. America was far better 100 years ago than now. America was far more peaceful. America had far less enemies. We didn't have any September 11th 100 years ago. We didn't have any terrorism of any kind 100 years ago. So, we can look at this comparison and realize the folly, the fallacy, the flaw of this sick, traitorous policy of the Jewish occupational government led by George Chavez Goy Bush. In a lot of ways, this government, you know, let me back up. A lot of times we hear this notion, for example, that we are supremacists. Oftentimes in the daily Jewish press, we will be called white supremacists. And the implication is that we are trying to dictate to others how they must live and what they must do, and we are trying to dominate and rule over, reign over, the inferior mud races. Well, in actuality, it's the Jewish occupational government that is the supremacist institution. They are the supremacists, and let me tell you why. This government dictates to the world how they must live, how people must live, how they must treat their citizens, what kind of form of government they must have. For example, we hear a lot of talk about how we need to have democracies everywhere and how this country and that country is not a democratic country, so therefore they're bad, they're evil, and we try to put pressure on them and perhaps even militarily attack them for not having a, quote, democracy, unquote. What is that but supremacy? That is a supremacist mindset, that you want to rule over these other countries around the world, determine what's good for them, tell them what kind of government they must have, and use military or economic force, persuasion if you want to call it that, to change their form of government. How quaint. They are the true supremacists. And of course, this Jewish occupational government uses an international military to push the interests of Jews and lackeys by force, just like I said. The government wishes to say, well, this group over here is not democratic, and so they are a terrorist threat, or they are bad, they are evildoers, they are part of the axis of evil that we have now with Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. It's almost juvenile. In fact, it is juvenile. The axis of evil. First we had the evildoers, and now we have the axis of evil. You notice how notice how George Bush is using the word axis. That is no coincidence, my brothers and sisters, because, of course, during the Second World War, or the Great Fratricidal War, as I like to call it, in which the Jews inveigled the white people of the world to kill each other for their own interests, the Germans fighting the French, and the French fighting the Germans, and this massive slaughter that caused such misery for white people and such power to the Jews, gave so much power and influence to the Jews, far more than they had before the war. It is no coincidence that during that war, Germany, Italy, and Japan were called the Axis powers, and now Bush is using that word Axis to connote the three countries of Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. No coincidence at all. Notice the propaganda. Notice the subtlety. Most people out there probably didn't even realize what was going on, but in the back of their mind, they have negative impressions of the word axis. And so when they hear axis of evil, they automatically hate whoever Bush is talking about, axis, and then they hear the word evil, and naturally they become lapdogs all the more when they hear that. The axis of evil. Well, the true axis of evil is New York City, Washington, D.C., and Tel Aviv. That's the true axis of evil. Let's put it that way from now on, my brothers and sisters. That is the true axis of evil. The Jews and their lackey white traitors behind them, stooging for them, that are determined to eviscerate a future for white people. They are determined to use you and I as stepping stones to their own eternal domination of this world. Well, my brothers and sisters, it's time to shift gears a bit. Let us shift gears to York, Pennsylvania. Plans for return to York. Yes, indeed, we are planning to make a return to York, Pennsylvania soon. At this time, we are pursuing and acquiring the necessary information to file a lawsuit against the Martin Library in York. We do this because, as you might know to recall, the Martin Library has passed a policy change basically saying that any group that they deem controversial, meaning us, will have to pay for a $1 million insurance policy. Well, as noted in the daily press out there, if the Martin Library were to enact an insurance policy that applies to all groups, I don't think we could challenge that. We probably could not challenge that policy change. However, the Martin Library has actually blatantly said it only applies to us. This insurance policy requirement only applies to controversial groups, and they have actually said furthermore that yes, this policy change was made to keep us out. Well, we came to York on January 12th, had a wonderful meeting in the Martin Library. I spoke to 70 supporters there, and there were hundreds outside who couldn't get in. The police wouldn't let in. And we had a wonderful time. We spread the message of white racial loyalty, and we spread the message worldwide. It was on CNN, it was on other news channels, and it was in newspapers across the country. I'm still getting newspaper clippings, newspapers across the country and around the world. It made news, our great cause in York that day. But it looks like we will be coming again soon, and it wasn't exactly my plan to come so soon, and it wasn't my plan to come back to the library because, like I say, we didn't have everyone who wanted to hear my speech in that library that day. Some people were shut out of the library. I didn't like that, and I don't like that, and it was my plan instead to give a speech outside somewhere, to come back to York and give a speech in an open field to our supporters, to the hundreds of supporters, so that everyone can hear me. Well, now here's my plan. My plan is to come back to York, come back to the library, and give my speech outside as well. I am thinking, in fact, about a two-day event. 2 days of white racial loyalty, white racial activism, white racial power in the streets in the community of York, Pennsylvania. And we can thank our friends at the Martin Library for forcing our hand. And let me not, you know, necessarily appear to be so sarcastic or facetious. But the fact of the matter is that we have to oppose this policy change. Because if we don't oppose it, if we don't sue the Martin Library for enacting this blatantly unconstitutional policy, other libraries out there across the country would take up the cue and pass similar policies. Policies that will, of course, effectively stop us from meeting in public libraries. As you well know, public libraries are a very important part of the World Church of the Creator's tactics. We believe in meeting in public libraries for a lot of reasons. Number one, they can't stop us from meeting in public libraries. Unless there's a policy like this in effect, and of course, like I say, we're going to challenge and defeat and destroy this policy, they can't stop us from meeting there. Public libraries are for the public, and you cannot discriminate on viewpoint and effectively stop an organization you don't like or a cause you don't like from meeting there. Number two, everybody knows where the public library is. Community people have more access to a public library than, say, other institutions or other places. Number three, because it is a public institution, It is true that law enforcement will be present. They will automatically be present, really. The library itself will, the particular library itself will request that police be present, and by so doing, we have more chances of having a safe and secure event for our adherents and for even more importantly in some ways, the people who are coming to listen to us who are uncertain, who don't know where they stand. We want them to feel that, yes, they can come to a meeting, they can bring their kids, they can bring their families, and they can come inside this meeting room and not have a brawl inside the room. And we haven't had a brawl ever since the brawl that occurred in Peoria, Illinois, last year at the Peoria Public Library. Ever since then, police presence has been heavy, and we haven't had a problem ever since. So those are three reasons why we have to challenge this policy, why we have to continue having our meetings in public libraries across the country, and we will. We cannot allow any other library out there to look at this and say, hey, okay, that's the way to stop the World Church of the Creator and Matt Hale from speaking. Let's just go ahead and pass $1 million insurance policy. Well, for one thing, and I note this as well, I read an article in one of the York newspapers in which an individual cited from the Martin Library the policy change that had been made in Schaumburg, Illinois, a city that also has to be challenged. And see, here we go. We got the situation where Schaumburg passed $1 million insurance policy also. They passed it before York, and York used that as their justification. They said, well, Schaumburg did it. See, it's spiraling out of hand. It's becoming a domino effect. And if we don't bring a lawsuit very, very soon, and we will be very, very soon, other libraries will follow suit. And before you know it, we're having to sue libraries around the country. And, of course, that becomes expensive. Lawsuits are expensive propositions. And we don't want to have a situation where we have to sue every time or sue hundreds of times these lawsuits, or these libraries, I should say, because they enact a policy that could have been nipped in the bud earlier, such as now. So that's the plan. The lawsuit will be filed soon. The ACLU has involved itself in this matter, and we appreciate that. It's in our interest to have the ACLU perhaps even handle this case, and we have been talking with them. Certainly, the end justifies the means. If they bring the suit and they spare the church a lot of money and a lot of legal expenses, then all the better. And, of course, that's in Pennsylvania. York, Pennsylvania is in Pennsylvania, and I'm in Illinois. And it would be difficult logistically for me to file the suit on behalf of myself and perhaps the church if I could, and perhaps the judge would allow me in that case maybe to represent the church. It would be difficult for me to file that suit in Pennsylvania and be prosecuting that suit from here. So, yes, we welcome the ACLU involvement, and the library has no chance of winning this case. I say that with great confidence, obviously. Of course, I'm not one to make absolute predictions usually, but in this particular case, the law is very clear that you cannot precondition a constitutional right, such as the right to assembly, the right of equal protection under the law, etc., the right of freedom of speech, based on the payment of money. I know further that there is no damage at all done to the Martin Library in our meeting on the 12th, and so the library can't even claim that there was damage done, and so therefore they have to provide for future possibilities of damage and indemnify themselves. No, they can't even make that claim because the police were there in force. The police searched people when they walked in. Not one chair was damaged. Not one person did anything to the walls. Not one anti-racist scoundrel, that is, because certainly none of our people would trash the library like the anti-racists would love to do. Remember always that the anti-racist protesters in York were individuals that really are confused and very befuddled, very sick individuals. Any person, for example, that punches a horse, one of the guys, in fact, one of the anti-racists punched a horse, was arrested for punching a horse. What kind of an individual would punch a horse? What kind of an individual would throw bags of urine as they did? I don't know of any of our guys being hit with bags of urine, but in any case, it is in the press accounts, and on this particular point, the press is telling the truth. And I've checked with our members and our supporters, and this is what happened. In York, PA, you had some people throwing bags of urine. Now, what kind of individual would do such a thing? A sick person, a very perverted person. That is our opposition. That is the opposition, at least in the streets. Well, of course, the more intelligent and certainly probably more decent, in fact, opposition behind the scenes is out there as well. So that's the situation with York. York, I might note, was one of the original capitals of the United States. And now it's going to become a capital for the white racial loyalist movement, in a sense. It's going to be a bastion. We are going to come back to York very soon. And anytime any institution tells us we can't meet, we're going to meet. They tell us no, we're going to tell them yes. We believe very strongly, once again, that never, never can we allow our rights to be violated with impunity. We must make them regret every step in the sand that they take to deprive us of our liberties, and we will. Lastly, on this week's episode of In Klassen We Trust, and we've covered a heck of a lot of things on this episode, I wish to note that I am looking for qualified individuals to become state leaders in the church. This is something that we've been building up for some time. We need to have more organization on the state level. We need to, in fact, replicate the national activities directed by yours truly on the state level. We've had these national activities. Let's make them local now. Let's make them state-specific. Let's have a person in charge of all the creators, leading all the creators in all 50 states one day. Right now, we don't have state leaders. We need to change that. And I'm calling upon you, if you feel you are qualified, if you are a member of the World Church of the Creator, if you are prepared to take your ministry exam, and that's one requirement that I certainly have, is that you become an ordained minister in the church. If you feel that you are qualified and you are ready to seize the bull by the horns and become a leader in your state and organize aggressively creators in your state, meet with creators in your state, maintain constant contact with members in your state, and promote aggressively creativity and the church in your state, I'd like to hear from you. I would like to entrust you, if you are worthy and qualified and capable, with the position of state director in the church. I believe that this will make our church far more efficient. It will enable me to focus on more national and international activities and enable you to prove yourself and put your talents into play more vividly, more efficiently, more dynamically. Well, my brothers and sisters, we are just about out of time, or we will be out of time on this week's episode of In Klassen We Trust. Once again, if you have not yet read the three basic books of creativity, Nature's Eternal Religion, The White Man's Bible, and Salubrious Living, obtain your copies today. They will change your life for the better. They will make your life more understandable, more positive, more dynamic, more proud. Once you realize, for example, that you are part of nature's finest, that you have a very specific role and purpose to play in this world, you have goals to live by. You have something to look forward to. You have something to wake up to. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and I put an immediate smile on my face because I know the previous day I did my duty for my white people, and there's a lot to do the coming day for my white people. We are more than our individual selves. The selfish people out there, they want to talk about how me, 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 that's all that matters. Well, that's not all that matters in this world. We have a duty and an obligation to our people. Our people deserve a better future. They are not getting it. All the indications are there. Our economic ability is going down because our country is being flooded with Mexicans, and we're having to compete with the third world internationally. We have a situation where there's more and more race mixing, more and more of our white people are going the suicidal course of mongrelizing their blood, destroying their future, destroying their children, destroying their race. We have the situation where our own culture is becoming negrified, and whatever is left of our culture is being shunned by our white people, especially the white youth. Just think of it this way, my brothers and sisters. We have a situation where more white youth know who Michael Jordan is than Ludwig von Beethoven, for example. More white youth know who Michael Jackson is than, say, Thomas Edison. And it's sick. It's absolutely sick. More white youth will wear a shirt with Martin Luther King's picture on it than Ben Clausen, or Adolf Hitler, or George Lincoln Rockwell, or great pioneers for the white race. This must change. This must change now. We must rescue the white youth, white people in general, from the filth of race mixing, of racial degradation. And it's up to you. It is up to you and I to make this change, to change history. We are changing history right now. It's slow, and it might be too slow if we don't increase our activities across the board. So once again, organize, spread the message. If you think you're qualified to become a state leader of the church in your particular state, contact me immediately. There's going to be, of course, a lot more to talk about in next week's episode of In Class and We Trust. We talked about a lot on this particular episode. I hope you found it informative and inspiring. We can, we will, and indeed we must win this racial holy war. Rahala!